Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful time. Happy New Year and all the good stuff. I know this is probably coming out third week in January. So I should have said Happy New Year beforehand, but we batched up a load of podcasts during Christmas time so I could take a few weeks off. Podcast time. And it is amazing to start the year, or not even start the year, third week in, I know, sorry. Alan Fitzpatrick, owner of We Are The Brave, released an album called Machine Therapy not so long ago. Remixes are coming out of that right now. Don't forget to go check that out after this podcast. Really, really nice chat. Really good conversation. Love this. So without further ado, Alan Fitzpatrick. Alan Fitzpatrick, we are live. How's it going, man?
Yeah, man, all good. Happy New Year.
You too, mate. It's good to finally meet you. We've been speaking for a while, so it's good to speak face to face. How's life?
Yeah, it's all good. All good. I think it's quite a nice, relaxing start to the year for me. Really, I had flu on not the 28th or 29th, so yeah. I've had the quietest Christmas and New Year ever. And my New Year's Eve was cancelled. I was supposed to be in Rome.
Yeah.
So I feel like tip top because I'm over the flu now, and I haven't got any regrets from coming into the new year feeling hanging or feeling coming from like an afters or anything like that. So I'm all good.
That's the worst thing, isn't it? When you kind of start the year and you're absolutely hanging because you've just done like a fuck ton of shows and you're like, I don't know what to do with myself. I've got to do the whole year again and still feel shit at the beginning of it. It's not fun.
Yeah. It can be super stressful like that. I mean, I've got off quite lucky. I mean, although it's annoying to have some cancelled gigs as well, I've got quite a chilled January because a lot of my stuff has had to be postponed based on where it is. You know,
really?
I'm supposed to be in France next week, and they're not letting any English people in the country anyway. Can't even transit through France.
They just hate us, don't they? The French just hate us.
So there's that, and obviously I've got Northern Ireland and a few other bits around that basically aren't open. So end of the month, I'll be back to work.
Nice, man.
Last weekend of this month.
Yeah, I start next week again. Yeah. I'm back to the States, and it's kind of like every weekend from then on, really. But it's... Yeah, it's all, the world's a strange place right now. It's a very strange place.
It's weird, man. It's weird. It's been weird for a long time. We're coming up 2 years of weirdness now, aren't we? March 20, whatever it is, will be the sort of, I guess, the anniversary of the first lockdown in the UK and stuff. So it's coming.
Have you found it?
I mean, it was crap, you know. I didn't know what was going on and went through a lot of ups and downs in terms of... you know, feeling a bit lost and not knowing really what I was doing with myself, really. But mean, all I've done for the last 15, 20 years is music orientated stuff and touring and everything else. So when that was halted, it was like, well, what do I do now? So I didn't even make music for the first 6 months. I was just basically, you know, with no word of a lie, like come 11 o'clock, I'd open a beer and watch telly, and it would just spiral from there. You would do nothing. Like proper lazy, and I think 6 months in, I was like, right, let's put this to some good use, and that's when the Machine Therapy came about, and I was writing loads of music, and you know, anyone that's heard that album can sort of hear that I wasn't really writing for clubs, I was just making music, because there weren't, you know, it's just the only way music was getting consumed was on Spotify or any other streaming service or whatever, so it allowed me to just not be constricted to kind of dance halls, just write music, and luckily it all coherently came together as an album, and it could have just been all over the place, because I quite literally was going into the studio making music and not having any real agenda, really.
That was the weirdest thing for me as well, is that you're like, so for the first 6 months, I just wrote a fuck ton of music.
Yeah.
A lot of it was club orientated. And then I went through the phase of like, I don't know what's even going to sound good in a club, because we don't know when clubs are going to be back again.
Yeah,
and it was
like,
that's when I was like, okay, I can just write what the fuck I want. But it was a weird concept, because I think it was the kind of similar for a lot of us, where we were just like, we write dance music and we write club music, and it's kind of just our business, right? We have to write that because we want to play music in our sets.
I always say that the writing part is, as much as it's enjoyable, the writing part is also your business card to go touring. You know what I mean?
100%. We need it, but it was massive dip in streams during lockdown as well, because people just weren't going to clubs. People weren't experiencing the music in the clubs.
I think people were sort of nostalgically looking back, so no one was interested in any new music because no one had any relationship with any of those tracks. But you know, people were listening to kind of old stuff stuff that they did have reminiscing or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Wishing there was clubs open. But in terms of new music, it was a nightmare because, no one really wanted to kind of, you know, people learn a love of a track on the dance floor, hearing it on the radio, or like, you know, having it on in the car when they're with their mates and they go into a venue, or they, you know, you build up I don't know if you're the same, but when you, you close your eyes, you have a memory of something that reminds you of that track, or you build a relationship with it. When you haven't got any of that, then the new music sort of struggles because it goes over everyone's head.
Yeah. And I think there was a lot of music that people purposely wrote to kind of, I call it formulaic nostalgic music, where it kind of like sounded like an old trance record
massive piano hook.
Exactly. That like it brings, it's like the sense, like the sense of smell. You kind of go past somebody and like, fuck, that reminds me of like whatever, ex-girlfriend or whatever. And then like, fuck, that smells really good. But it was kind of the similar thing with like a lot of the music that came out in lockdown that did really well was like formulaic nostalgic music.
Yeah, or just big hooky.
Yeah.
So yeah, stuff that like, I mean, we're all, the term kitchen rave or whatever, people were like lockdown raves, whatever. It was like you started to consume your dance music when you're like making pasta or doing stuff that generally you would associate with going out, and you were doing it all in your house. So, yeah, you're right. I think those sort of bigger records that made people feel nostalgic seemed to do quite well. What was weird for me, though, is like I can't think off the top of my head how many, but there's probably two or three releases I did throughout the lockdown period that I put out before I'd ever even heard it in a club.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it?
And obviously, I was so paranoid because obviously first weekend back when clubs open, I'm playing tracks, I'm thinking, if this hi-hat's too loud, it's out. You know, I can't do anything about that. Like, if I need to push the bass, or if I need to give this kick some mid-range... Yeah. None of that can happen. It's basically there. Like, if it sounds shit, it's shit. I can't do anything about it. So that was weird. Like, you know, going in quite blind from that. I mean, I'll play all my stuff out and then I'll tweak a bit or change this or whatever. But never loads. But I think not having that ability to do that, and music just having to be, you know, trusted by a master and engineer once it's gone out, and you're like, yeah, sounds good at home. It sounds good. I mean, I don't know if that's any good when it goes out. But
it made us try and be better producers, because a lot of the time for me, I don't know about you, but I just like literally just spend zero time actually on the making of it sound good. It's more like a vibe. And then and then I get so used to the vibe, it's technically not the best sounding record, but it works for the dance floor.
I'm the same. I'm not a producer that spends, I don't spend 2 hours on a kick drum, because I would just close my computer and go, oh, yeah, I'll do some hours today. I would much prefer to throw in a shit sounding kick drum
and then
lay down, basically get like 2 or 3 minutes of a groove going, and then going, right, now I'm going to change that kick, so it's crap. But like, you work in with a sort of structure of getting to a point where you're like, yeah, this is wicked, this is happening. And you start finessing things, you know what I mean?
No, I totally agree with that. It's, for me, it's just about the vibe. Like, the records that you make in a couple of hours are the best records. The records that take months to finish, you're like, yeah, this isn't it. It's not the one.
Yeah, it starts to get pretty difficult when it gets.
I want to know, because like, I've been aware of you for quite a long time now, but where did it all start for you?
For me, it was like basically the whole kind of early rave generation of the sort of early 90s. I was listening to kind of, you know, Dreamscape, Tasmania, Helter Skelter, One Nation, all these kind of like tape pack raves on my Walkman as a kid at school, you know. And I'd sort of two sides to my musical taste. I was one part of me was like, you know, drum and bass, hardcore, rave, breaks, techno, hard house, that kind of early 90s sound. And the other half was like, I was banging to the Beatles and Oasis, and I was listening to, like, my early school days, I was either like looking like, I had hair then, so I either looked like Liam Gallagher, or I'd look like Liam Gallagher stumbling out of a rave, so more like an Ian Brown, you know what I mean? So, but yeah, so I think with a mixed group of friends and my sort of culture was all that early 90s stuff started getting me into sort of rave music and dance music. And from that, when I was 15, I think I was, we had fake IDs and we got into Slinky and Bournemouth, and that's when I was first seeing DJs play. And the record shop where we used to buy the tape packs, they obviously sold all vinyl on that as well. So shortly after, I managed to get some money together to get a pair of turntables, and I was buying records. But when I was buying records, it was like multiple styles. I didn't really know what I was buying. I was just going, oh, that sounds good, that cover looks good.
Yeah.
You know, oh, that record's blue, I'll buy that. And like, you know what I mean? And then I slowly was realized that at home you can't mix 170 BPM or jungle into like trance, so it was like, let's try and
choose, you know, one thing
where you want to go. But ultimately I was a bit of a sponge. I used to take in everything. I think we miss it now, like there's so many brands, so many club nights that are built around a sound. But when late 90s, early 2000s, you could have you know, all sorts of DJs on one lineup, and the music style might jump all over the place, you know. So
I remember some of the first shows that I did that were like early 2000s, and it was like one room would be like house and techno, the second room would be like drum and bass, and the third room would be like happy hardcore. And
yeah, exactly.
It would just be like you'd have like a huge mix mash of like people in the club that would eventually all be together and all understand each other's music, where now it just feels like there's just like massive barriers. Like you go to a tech house night and you only go to a tech house night. You go to like a drum code party and you only go to a drum code party.
Well, this is the thing. That's basically, that is just, unless it's a festival of different stages, like that is the norm now. Where, you know, I remember when I was first saw like, say Carl Cox, for example, it was probably early 2000s, Slinky. And then you might have like Jim Masters or sort of Jeff Mills, people like that on the same lineup. But then in between them, there'd be someone like Lisa Lashes or Andy Farley or someone that's like a hard house DJ. Or you'd have like Andy C and then like someone that was like a gatecrasher resident, like Scott Bond or whatever, on the same lineup, Scott which Bond. Is all over the place. But it was better then, because I think that's like what helped me kind of have a bit more of an eclectic taste in dance music. Like even now, obviously I make techno, I make house, I make breaks or whatever else, and somewhere in between. But that's because of like being into it all. There are some people, and there's some kids now that make techno that only listen to techno 24 hours a day, and like they don't know anything outside of that box, which is fine if that's what you're into. But for me, I'm like, I draw my inspiration from all sorts of different genres.
Well, I also just think though, if you're very like single-minded focusly on genres, I think it doesn't last long, as in it's we can get burnt out very easily. I don't know about you, but for me, like, I can't listen to electronic dance music all the time because I just get bored.
I very rarely listen to dance music, and that sounds weird because people always say that to me, like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, if I'm going through my promos, if I'm sat in the studio, if I'm on tour, if I'm actually DJing, it's quite a lot of my life is listening to dance music. Exactly. So anytime I'm not doing anything work-related, I'm, I'll be listening to like Bon Iver or something. I'll have something different on. I won't be listening to dance music. Very rarely am I going, right, I'm going to cook for the family now, so I'm going to stick on a drum and bass mix or something. It just doesn't happen. Like, I would put on Ben Howard, or I'd put on Radiohead, or, do you know what I mean? I'm in a different space.
Yeah, I'm the biggest sad boy listener. Like, I just listen to like sad boy depressing music the whole time. It's suicidal playlists all the time, but I love it. It's so much happier for me. And you're right, you need a break from it to kind of get away from, I think to get inspiration for me, it's just getting the fuck out of dance music. Nothing better.
If I sort of say to myself, right, you know, I'm going to be in this room making my music today, then I will usually sort of make a decision the day or the few days leading into it. If I know I'm going to do a studio session, that I won't be listening to anything that's related to what I'm making, because I don't want to be influenced. I just want to be fresh, you know. I'll make the best music when I've come into the studio having listened to something that is completely the polar opposite to what I'm going to be doing.
Yeah.
Because I haven't been kind of, you know, I hate feeling when you get in the studio, all right, what's big at the moment? What's working? What are people into? Like, I don't care about that. I'm just making music. And if it works, it works. I find this is quite a mad thing as well. Like, especially with like the way music is now for new artists getting into the scene. Like, everything can be a bit like, does your track fit that playlist? Does your track fit this genre? Especially with just, you know, like algorithms and this and that. You're like, can I be just an artist and make what I want to make? Or do I have to try and fit it into that box or that box? It's quite tough for new people.
It's tough. I think it's tough for the whole industry where you're just constantly trying to fit in, and like
that's a big pressure. That's a real stress on people's mental health.
Yeah,
and I'll be honest, I've been for a lot of periods where I'm like, you know, I've been in this game a long time now. This year, I would have been in the scene kind of 20 years at a very different level, obviously, of course. Probably the level I'm at now, operating for a good 10, 12 years touring. But you have moments where you're thinking, how much longer have I got? There's these sort of new people coming up, are they going to like take your spot and this and that? Actually, like a few years ago, I decided that I don't care. I'm just doing my thing.
Yeah.
And when my time's up, my time's up. And if people are still into my music, they're into my music. And that's the best way is to, my friends would say the same thing. It's like that quote of just stay in your lane and just do your thing. And don't worry about anyone else. Because when you start, it's like Instagram fame and everything else. You start questioning all that stuff, and the music comes second, and then you start to kind of get proper stressed out of it all.
It's that saying, isn't it? Comparison is the thief of joy. And it's kind of, what do we start doing? Why did we start doing this? We didn't start music because we thought we could make a fuck ton of money out of it. We didn't think music was going to start paying our mortgages or give us a nice lifestyle. We did it because we fucking loved it, and we couldn't stand the possibility of someone bossing us around in a 9-to-5 job.
And, being a creative, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I always refer to it with, like, if you look at sort of fine artists and stuff like that, bit of a weird comparison. But if you're looking at sort of, I'm sure that these famous painters, your Van Goghs and other people, didn't go, oh, I wonder, is his painting better than mine? Yeah. How many works has he got? How much is this sold for? They don't care. There's art. Mm. You know what I mean? We should be the same when you're making music. It doesn't matter.
How do you take yourself away from that, though? Because, like, for me, I completely agree with you. There's some times where I'm like, fuck this industry. It's fucking terrible. And then other days I'm like, fuck everybody else. Like, I'm just doing my thing. And yeah, like a release will come out and like it might do really bad or it might do really well. But like sometimes I'm just like in the worst frame of mind. But how do you kind of get through that?
I guess it's just becoming, I don't think you ever really get over a lot of that. Yeah. I'm the same. Sometimes I'll drop a release and I think this is going to do really well. And I'm like, oh man, that just doesn't. It hasn't compared to something else. But I think you just get thick skin. You just do it. You're just doing it enough. And you know, you can become a bit sort of, yeah, and sort of numb to it, a bit more thick skin, really. And I think I'm the same as you. Sometimes I'll be like buzzing about being in the industry, and sometimes I'm like, this industry's buckled as fuck and needs to change. And then sometimes I'm like, it's great. Yeah. So it's, you know, I think that is a good, it's good to be like that, though, I think, because it will come across in some of your music.
Totally. Yeah.
You'll know there's some tracks you've done that if you can listen back to a few years later and be like, oh, I know what headspace I was in there. But I'll be honest, I'm guilty of it. I can also look back on some of my music and think, I clearly made that for a reason, of to like get me somewhere where I needed to be or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And some stuff blows up and creates monsters that you didn't expect at all. And then you kind of almost regret that those tracks. I've got a couple of tracks that I'm like, you know, We Do What We Want is a big track for me. It was everyone loves, right? And people love, especially punters and your base, and you know, 20 million streams or whatever it's got. Fucking can't stand that track.
I knew you were going to say that.
Because I've played it like, I haven't played it for many years now, but obviously it was like 6 years old. People still ask for it. It's a track that, again, it launched We Are the Brave. It was the first release, but it's made for a bit of fun. It's made for a summer festival tune.
Yeah.
And, you know, if David Bowie, God rest his soul, imagine if you ask people like that, like, you know, what do you think of like Life on Mars or this and that? He'd be like, no, I'm never playing that live again. You know, and someone like him is quite a good inspiration. I've got Bowie's tattoos on my leg. He's one of my fanboy Bowie and Prince and people like that. But there, what was great about artists like Bowie is once he put an album out, he'd never ever tour that album again or never tour the tracks on that album.
Really?
If you ever went to see him and you were like two albums deep and he was like touring the third album, that you'd only hear the music from the third album. He
wouldn't
be playing. Yeah. And it's almost a way of like putting that to bed and doing the next thing.
Because I was speaking to the Camel Fat Boys about this as well. And they had this with like Cola, and it's like, there's the kind of two sides of the argument, isn't it? It's like, well, a lot of the fans are coming to see you because they know you through that track and they want to hear that track. But then there's that other side of it. It's like, well, we want to also kind of, not without sounding douchey, but like you kind of want to push boundaries and kind of play new shit and kind of get people onto the new shit. But
this
like,
is my thing. I have this same kind of battle with various people at various times where, like, you know, if I went to go and see a band that's my favorite band, you're going to want to hear all the tunes that you know and you want to sing along to it as loud as you can and throw your beer around and go mental, right?
Yeah.
However, for those tunes to have been those tunes, at some point they had to be new, fresh music that someone didn't know, and then it was broken as this is the new music. So we're purveyors of educating people and purveyors of pushing new and exciting music onto punters that come and see us. So it's our job, it's our duty as DJs to push new music, because that's the future classics. You know what I mean? The music that you're playing now to people could be the next biggest track of yours. It's very hard to sort of somewhere in the middle. Listen, when I play, I will still drop a few of my big tunes because you naturally will. But I've definitely become more comfortable since re-touring from lockdown and stuff like that. Basically after having 18 months of mulling things over and shooting at home, I've definitely become more comfortable now to accept that I'm pushing new music and to not feel pressured to have to play, they're all going to want to hear that, so I'll drop it. And it's everyone's responded really well to it. I mean, you know, we play a lot of shows, and you know, the kind of DM going, "You're fucking shit. You didn't play that track. Why? I bought a ticket to see that track. You didn't play it. I'm not coming to see you again." And then you reply and be like, "Yeah, I'm sorry." You know, and they're like, "Ah, oh, sick set though. Yeah, it was wicked." Yeah. So they, you know, it's like one or the other. So I'll to a lot of stuff, but there's sometimes when I get quite nasty, like, "Oh, this is this," and then you bite back, and then they're like, "Oh no, I mean, that's wicked. That was a sick set though. And what's this new one? What's that new one?" So you know, it's like it's one or the other. So you know, but I think nowadays people know that holding your phone up and asking for a track that's 10 years old is very unlikely that anyone that you go and see is going to play their tracks like that. They want to play their new stuff.
Well, and also it's like how from like, I've got records from when I was like signed to Dirty Bird that I would just never play because I don't play that type of music anymore. And it's like, that's been and gone. You just got to sign that off. But I guess a question for you is when you came back out of COVID, especially in the UK, because you have like people that were 16 years old that had never seen you before play.
Yeah.
Come into shows. Cause I played a show, I played Mintfest, and I was in the crowd and I was like, when COVID happened, these kids weren't even allowed to go to a venue. Some of them did. Obviously, we've all had fake IDs and shit, but a lot of these people had never
been. The majority of people, post COVID is still here, but well, I mean post lockdown.
Yeah,
those people. Yeah, like if you were 16 in March 2020, chances are you are 18 when you get in a club. So you're you're right. People have had a long time of listening to stuff and then finally getting in and maybe being a bit like, oh no, I didn't play this, this, and this.
But I also think the other way, because there's a whole new crowd of people that like might not even know who we are. That are just go into the clubs because. Like, I never forget this years ago. One of my girlfriends, just a mate, she was like definitely not into house music at all. Like not one bit. And then she texted me, she's like, "I'm gonna go see Patrick Toppin tonight." And I was like, sick. Like, I didn't know you listen to house music. And she was like, "I don't." I'm like, great. Yeah, but I think because house music's so fashionable now.
This is another weird thing, isn't it? Like, I do find that, like, because we're touring loads and we've been in the industry a long time, you always assume, oh, everyone's seen me. I'm old hat now. Everyone's seen me. It's fine, you know. But the amount of people that you still message you and they're like, oh, you know, I still see replies on comments and like, oh, my 2022 list is definitely to see these DJs. Boom, 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 and you're in that little list of people. You're like, it's recycling all the time, and you're right. It could just be that. People want to be out and want to be in these environments and you just happen to be on the bill on that Friday when they want to go out and then, you know, you might win someone over. So.
I think that's the best thing for me is I go into pretty much every club set, even if it's a headline set, like I'm going in and going 70% of the people don't know who I am.
Yeah. Like, that's usually my kind of approach to things is like, this is why, you know, I've got quite an energetic sort of performance style when I'm playing. I'm like jumping around, I'm sort of having it. And, you know, I always treat, as cliche and as weird as it sounds, I try and treat every set like it could be your last one, especially coming out of all the nonsense. Like, but by doing that, I do think you give big or small, 10 people or 10,000 people, like you give everyone an experience from like, what they should expect from you.
Yeah,
I always used to hate it when you could read, you know, articles way before social media when it was like editorial magazine-y stuff and people would be like, yeah, I saw so-and-so and they were really, really bad. You know, didn't play very well. They did have no energy. And then you're like, yeah, they did 6 gigs before they got to you and they haven't slept yet because they've had travel. So by the time they've got to you, like they, you know, they're trying, they're just not, they haven't got it. Yeah. So. I think there's a degree of like having an element of performance that you can be kind of happy with, but also there is also like, we're all human. So sometimes you are feeling under the weather, you're knackered or you're this or that, but to try and, my motto is to try and keep those two things separate. And no matter if I'm feeling shit, then I'll have a shot of tequila and I'll try and perform.
Yeah.
And then I'll deal with my tiredness or whatever after.
Yeah, no, totally. For me, it's exactly the same. It's like, my view is people are paying to see you. I have to do my utmost best to make sure that that 20 quid that they paid to come into the club, they are making that, that they're going to get the best of that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, 100%. You do have to give it everything. And as I say, I really felt like getting back into the first couple of weekends of shows. In the UK, we opened up in July this year. So the first few shows in July and early August, but it was like I didn't know what it would be like. I had a few reservations, some weird stuff, right? I was like, right, I've missed this completely, wholeheartedly missed performing. But when I get in that club, will I like it? Or will I be like, oh, fucking hell, this is fun. Will I be paranoid that there's loads of people? Will I have anxiety about, I haven't stood in front of people. I've stood in front of a few streams, but I haven't stood in front of actual people for like 18 months. So a number of things, but my main concern was like, will I love this? And will this make me tingle in the way that it used to before all this? Because I was really paranoid that 18 months seemed like a long time. And, you know, weirdly, two or three tracks in, and I was like, mate, it's like I played last week.
It's like riding a bike, isn't it?
Yeah, like no, it was like nothing ever changed. It's like no one ever left. And that was great to sort of feel that. But I do think, there was a few paranoia bits there. It was like, and I imagine there has been some people that have gone back and then now they're like, well, I don't know if I want to do that anymore.
Yeah, you know? 100%. Because there has to have been.
It's a long, long time, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Why We Are The Brave? What was the kind of deal between starting the label?
So I started the label. I've had a few labels before through my sort of profile period and not my kind of professional career, but I think I was at a stage in my career where I really thought, I'm wanting my own legacy, really. I'm wanting something in 20, 30 years' time can still be running.
Yeah.
And I can look back and be like, I created that, And I wanted something that was mine. And I felt that my profile was at the right stage to launch it, really. But the sort of branding and the kind of We Are The Brave bits around it all was more a kind of...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I guess pushing like out there music at the time and being brave to make big decisions, do things differently and push music that was exciting and dare I say it, like brave releases that were kind of questioning the formulas or trying to do things a bit different.
Yeah.
And, that was the original sort of ethos around it. And I think... we're sort of 6 years in now. We're going for a bit of a facelift, actually. So it's like going into 2022, like looking a bit more. We've revamped some of the artwork, with some new pack shots. The event artwork's changed a bit, and basically just keeping it fresh. But I think overall, we've kept that ethos. It may have lost its way a little bit here and there when you start to get quite a big label and you're releasing big records.
It comes pressure, doesn't it? It comes pressure. Like you have two or three big records and then you release another record and it's not big and you're like, what the fuck's going on? Like,
well, and also because for me, it was like when you're releasing a lot of music and, some really blow up as massive tracks and then some don't do so well and some do. And yeah, some are like, okay. But you can get a bit stuck in, okay, we've got a big fan base now. The label's doing really well. I don't want to put out a record that's going to not do very well. I want my artists to be kind of, trusting us that their music's going to do really well. that's all good and all well, all said and done. That's the sort of the theory. But then what that does do is it causes you to sometimes not take risks on certain tracks and not do certain things. You think, don't know, some people may not get that. We sort of ditched that now and we're back in the sort of mentality of, well, if we like it, someone else will like it.
Yeah.
And we want to be pushing music that is more kind of a bit more, I guess, a bit more like out there and a bit more different to everything else. I think nowadays where you've got so many different people writing music and it's so accessible, you've got to open your ears a little bit. It's so easy to be stuck in a kind of, you know, we only release that this kind of sounding stuff, that sounding stuff.
I find it boring, man. I find it so boring when, like, there's old, like, especially some older, like Dirty Bird used to do it, like, really well, like, back in the early 2000s, mid-2000s. They would, everything they released was so fucking weird and so wonderful. And and then it kind of, it gets into those cogs, what you said. It's like, this formula worked, so let's do another one of those.
We've been there with the label. Yeah. We've done it where I've sometimes looked back. As I say, we're 6 years old coming up this year now, so there's been times where you're like, I was playing it safe a little bit there for that 6 months of releases, or like, but yeah, right, some labels have done it for longer and longer, and I think that's when they need a shake up. You need to be like, hang on, because what I find with that is you get labeled with, yeah, that's your sound
totally.
So the only demos you get sound like the last 10 records mm-hmm. you put out,
yeah,
because everyone thinks that's what it needs to sound like, and it gets a bit stale. Like with the demos we're getting now for Brave are all over the place, like not in terms of like genre. Obviously it's all techno music or like kind of club music, but it's like interesting stuff. So we're getting people that might send us something, and they might even say in their opening kind of sentence like, I don't know if this is gonna fit, Brave, but like, I'm sending it to you because I know you kind of have a little go on stuff.
Yeah,
and that's what excites me, that people can, I want people to like pick up. When I was, you know, a kid and you listen to kind of XL records, R&S,
exactly.
Warp records and all these, and I would buy those records, and sometimes because back when you're not getting previews of stuff online, I'd buy a record without even hearing it, thinking when I get home I can't wait to see what this sounds like, rather than, you know, goodbye and going, oh, that'll just be some drivel that's been this past release. And you're buying something, put it on and be like, is this going to inspire me, is this going to be exciting? And all of those old record labels, it didn't matter what they put out, they were like, just going for it. I mean, that's what I wanted to get Brave to be like, more like that, you know.
Tiga's Turbo Records or Turbo Recordings does that for me still. Like, some of the stuff he puts out is weird as fuck. And I'm like, I can't play this, but I like this. There's something about this. And I really respect that. Same with Alex at Hypercolor.
Like, exactly.
The stuff they put out. But I think by being that, from a label standpoint, your fans actually get to understand that that's what you're doing.
Exactly, yeah. I think for me as well, I've always wanted to do that as a fan perspective, and I feel like now the new era of kind of dance music 2.0, where we're out of the kind of COVID-y stuff and we're all having another crack at it, and we're putting a lot more focus on really becoming and doing that and putting more effort into doing it. But I guess from a business point of view, which is the kind of side the punters don't see, and you know you own a label, and that, you get to you in your head, you've got to get out of the mentality of me thinking Beatport are going to list that as something else or whatever, and you're like, it should be in that genre, not that genre. And you know, we just need to accept that we've all got to play a part and not just label stuff. Like, not shaming Beatport, love Beatport,
Of
course. But there are some times where I'm dropping music out and they've put it as something which is completely, I mean, we've all got ears, it isn't that. So don't list it as that, because then it's a problem. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's spot like Spotify, Apple Music. They're all the same.
People, a lot of people do this stuff. A lot of download sites will basically go, your label's techno, so that's a peak time techno track. But actually, it might be that we've just dropped a breaks track.
Mm.
You put it, you know, because that's what your label is. And I, from their point of view, it's like your fan base is in that genre, but you're eliminating other people hearing it. So I just think if I'm going to push Brave Records and push music that's exciting and a bit different, all within the spectrum of what we do, all playable to a DJ and all playable to me, you, and anyone else, but with tinges of other stuff going on to make it exciting, let's not just pigeonhole genres, because otherwise we're doing this for no reason. No one's going to hear it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think it's really important for labels to be doing that, because I think especially now, I think there's majority of labels are not looking at it like that. They're like, let's fucking knuckle down on what we're known for and let's make some money and let's kind of coin out, because we've had nearly 2 years of a lot of record labels weren't even releasing music during the pandemic because they're like, let's just hold out because we write club music and they can't be heard. I think it makes your label into like you said, like a legacy label that just
and we've got some exciting stuff as well. I've got another label called Apex, which is like still another play on the Predator stuff, Lions, Apex, Predators, blah, blah, blah. But basically, Apex is a sister label of Brave, which is more pushing like ambient, chill, electronica, kind of different sounding stuff. You know, I release on there under my alias Estrange, which is free. And we've got a lot of stuff coming this year on that label as well. I'm excited about kind of the, you know, pushing that sort of music, really. And even for me, I've got so much music coming this year as Alan Fitzpatrick. It's insane. Probably like a release a month, but throughout the whole year, based on the fact that because I did Machine Therapy, which came out in November, you obviously got a 12-month exclusivity period where you're doing your album stuff, you're dropping singles. Yeah. So as you know, punters may not always understand, but when you have signed an album, you might have written a lot of that 8 months ago. So between that 8 months, you've written 20 more tunes. So they all end up getting stacked on a shelf like, okay, well, you know, until this is out and everyone's kind of digested this, I'm still writing music every day. So I'm still making loads of music. So now I've got to a stage where that album's out and it's doing its thing, and that's great. And now I've got to kind of filter in all the other music I've released, I've made over the last sort of 18 months. So I've got so much stuff to come out, and you know, it makes you paranoid. You're like, should I sit and write new music when I've got all this to come out? But I think that's just the meal. I'm like, get that out, and then we'll start working on other stuff. And it's exciting. Lots of new music this year.
It's nice when it's like that. I'm exactly the same. Like, I generally work like a year in advance. So I'm now writing records for 2023, which is weird because all my records are done for this year already. But I think it takes a lot of pressure off for me. I don't know about you, but for me, it's like I have done the days of like, oh shit, I need to work out what my next release is. I need to work out my next release. But the joys of having your own record label is that you don't actually have to fucking worry about when your next release is coming out, because you can just be like, okay, these are the dates that I'm putting a release out, and it's done.
Yeah.
What was it like? I know you've done a few albums now. What is the process like for you when you write an album? Do you sit down and be like, album time, or do you like, no, let's just write a bunch of fucking records and see what works?
For Machine Therapy, it was a lot more like, you know, Shadows in the Dark that I did on Drum Code. It was like 10 years since I dropped that to Machine Therapy. So I was like, right, you know, a decade is a good time. I mean, I should put another album out. I mean, not that I haven't been pretty, I mean, I've been probably released every month throughout that 10 years, you know, or at least every couple of months.
Yeah.
So I've been putting, my output's been there, but I just haven't put it all together as 12 tracks. It's been like a 2-track EP, a 4-track EP, you know what I mean? And a few big, like, you know, longer ones, 6-track EPs and stuff like that. Those were more kind of collections of tracks that were just, that worked together on an EP. But for Machine Therapy, it was a lot more, I'm going to write an album. Yeah. So I'm going to, each time I was in the studio, I was focused on, you know, this may or may not be on the album. Obviously, you know, 12 tracks, I think, on Machine Therapy, I probably wrote 35 tracks.
Yeah.
You are like picking from that, but the process was, these are all potentials, if you know what I mean. So I did write with sort of album in mind, but not to the point where you're like, right, okay, that will definitely be the first one, and I need a sort of ambient interlude mid album thing. And, you know, none of that. It was just like, it came together quite nice once I had all the music, but it was definitely written in a sort of coherent plan to release as a body of work. Yeah.
Were you writing like extended versions and then cutting them down for Spotify, and or is the Spotify version the original?
For a bunch of them, I was sort of sticking around that like under 5 minute method based on the fact that I wanted to just make sure I could get at least 12 tracks on the album and it would run to around about an hour. I find that, especially with an album, I think if you run over an hour, I mean, some people in the game that I rate very highly will be like 40 minutes. As you, like, you get over that, and then you fucked it, you know?
Yeah.
I think for someone to sit and listen to an album, you can lose a bit of their attention going beyond an hour.
Especially nowadays.
Nowadays, yeah. But to answer the question in terms of was I writing things with that in mind, there's a few sort of ambient-y, more kind of melodic bits generally fitted around that 4.5 minutes, but most of the singles all come out of extended mixes. But I would have chopped the album version would have been chopped once I've finished the track.
Yeah.
So I'd probably like Warning Signs and stuff like that. I don't think we've taken too much off of that, but Call Out for Love and some others, they were like 8 minute tunes, which of them on the album they're 3.5 minutes, but no one's ever heard the 8 minute. Do you know what I mean? It's my version that I might gig with.
It's weird that, isn't it? When it's weird when you're like, okay, the album version has to be, or even just the Spotify or the DSP edit has to be shorter just because for the algorithms. But like, it's weird when you have a record, because there's some, we all know, especially with electronic records, some of them, they need 8 minutes.
Oh, 100%. And what's mad is before all this kind of stuff was a thing, you know, like We Do What We Want is a perfect example. That obviously came out in 2016, and that's had like 20 million streams or whatever. It's nearly nine minutes. If I'd have known, I'd have made it 3 minutes and had 40 million streams. You know what I mean? At the time, I was like, just put the record out. But nowadays, people are like, oh, you can't put an 8 minute track on Spotify. That won't get in any playlists. And probably rightly so. It probably won't. But so I think nowadays it's so normal to have an extended version on the release, because you've got like one for the listener, which is kind of straight in. And I guess it makes sense. Someone that's cooking their dinner don't really want 4 minutes of kick drums until a drop. You know, they just want bosh, drop.
Yeah.
You know, all of our longer mixes are so that we can have a 3 minute mix of it in a club before it drops. You know, they don't need to hear that kind of, you know, hi-hat and 909 and a ride for like 2.5 minutes before the bass line comes in. You know, I mean, that doesn't matter.
Yeah,
so sometimes it's cool to have the edits, but I think,
some of my favourite, like, albums, like Faithless, the Insomnia album or whatever album that was on, like, the intro to Insomnia was literally, like, 4 minutes long.
On the album. I've got some old albums that you used to listen in the car, and it'd be like, before, because if you've got short journeys of stuff, it used to do my head in, especially stuff like Insomnia is a great one. As when you're a kid and you're like listening to that, and it doesn't drop before you get to work.
No.
You're like, oh, I've just done the build up and now I'm off the bus. It's so annoying.
Yeah, it's like 2 minutes of church bells.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's like a weird record, and then it goes into the actual record. But there's something also about that where it's like, they're not thinking about the listener. They're thinking about purely what works.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's something kind of so organic about that, where now you can't, maybe just because we're all too business focused.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I bet Burial doesn't sit down and go, nah, this record has to be 3 minutes long. Like, like, I bet he goes, fuck them.
Exactly. Yeah, like, that's the thing. I mean, someone like him, and you're like, yeah, that tune's 29 minutes. But what's cool about some of that stuff, especially people like Burial, is that it almost feels like you're listening to an album because it changes. Like the first 4 minutes of, say, like that new Ravers EP or whatever, is quite a long track. Yeah. I use that as an example. The first like 4 minutes are nothing like the last 4 minutes. Yeah. Like, it's a totally different tune. It's almost like you've done a continuous mix of an album and then put it out as one track, you know, which is quite cool. But you are right, and I can't get out of that mentality that we are all, you know, your next release 100% fall into the algorithm so you can get it in a playlist, and so will mine, because you do if you just disregard that, you're not where you want to be with everyone else. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
And there's only so many people that will go, that's a bit knobby. Why are you doing that? Well, because it's cool. You know, I'll make 16-minute tunes, because eventually no one's going to listen to your music.
Yeah, and no one's going to book you.
I think you're cool, and it is. Yeah, it can be cool, and it can be up yours to the kind of algorithms. But ultimately, when you start seeing bookings do slide down like that, and your listing figures slide down, you think, why has it happened? Because no one's putting you in front of your fans because the music's too long.
Yeah, it's weird though, isn't it, to think though that tech companies have changed the listening span of people, or the attention span.
I think a lot of stuff's played into it. So I think even stuff like Instagram's 15-second limit on videos and stuff like that, it's done is it's fucked everyone's attention spans to be like, oh, that's a minute and a half long. I can't watch that. But if it's 15 seconds of a dog falling off a chair, then sweet, I'll watch that.
The best thing, yeah. You know, and I'll watch it 15 times because it's fucking great.
Because it's so short.
Yeah.
But then that's 15 plays versus one, isn't it?
Exactly.
So everyone's got caught up in it and put music and other things in that same kind of like way of consuming stuff. Like it's that scroll by culture. Do you know what I mean? Something to grab your attention quickly, and if it doesn't, it's like bosh. You know, get out of my.
No, but, definitely.
How do you fix that? Because that's what I worry about. Is, I mean, we're all sort of millennials or whatever else. We're in that world, so we know that's the case. But how? I don't know how you would ever get it to not be like that. It's almost like you just adapt and evolve with the way it is, because you can't change it. It's not going to go backward.
You're never going to change it, and there's so many people that try and fight against it, but you're. In the situation, like you said, people that fight it and just go down and down and down.
And respect to them for fighting it, but I do think you've really got to believe in something to do that, and then accept that what's going to happen is going to happen. I mean, you've got to, you know, if somebody said to me, "Right, no one's going to hear your music on these big playlists, and your music's not going to get in front of new fans unless you take a minute and a half off." I'll fucking take a minute and a half off then, because that's fine. You know. not that you're going to sell out on that culture, but ultimately I want people to hear my music. I make music for people to hear it.
Yeah.
So
music's for the masses. It's not the case, what's your thoughts on this NFT stuff?
Oh man, I'm still a bit kind of wet behind the ears with it all. You know, I mean, I think it's exciting. It's always exciting to have kind of new things, but I don't know. What I worry about with NFTs, I'm a bit of the crypto head anyway. I've got money in Bitcoin and I do a bit of that.
Yeah.
Not at any high level at all. I mean, I'm shit. I'll probably lose what I've put in, but my mates are good at it, so they tell me what I need to be good at. But ultimately, like, the only thing that worries me about NFTs is alienating fan bases, because there's a lot of people that aren't into crypto or Ethereum or any digital currency or not necessarily currency, but digital things at all. So by me saying, okay, I'm going to release a track and it's only going to be available on a one-time NFT, and when you buy that NFT, you get all the parts to it, and you have the rights to the parts, I don't.
Yeah.
Like, that's a cool thing for a fan, but ultimately you might have another million fans that think, it'd be well cool to have that. Like, I can't get access to that. So I think until it's a sort of kind of thing that everyone can get involved in, it is tough. That being said, the only way to get more people into stuff is to make it exciting and do it. Do you know what I mean? So maybe that will help get people more into that side of
I think it's about not making it as exclusive and kind of allowing, like, especially in our scene, like for NFTs is to, like, as tickets or as, like, fan club shit or something.
I like the whole one of one approach of stuff, but I'm worried about kind of, it's obviously great, and the fact that it's kind of got a resale, isn't it? So say you did an NFT, you minted an NFT, you sold it to one of your fans. I mean, they can then sell that for whatever they want to sell it for,
and then you still get paid from that.
Yeah, you still get paid from it. And I kind of, the way that it was obviously pioneered was, for me, that I when I first saw the NFT stuff, was around the NBA trading card stuff. Some of my mates have got some that are ridiculous. I don't know why. I don't understand why you want to give 20 grand to have a kind of gif of LeBron James dunking. That's it. That's all you got. Like, why? I could Google that. I'll find the same video. Some of it, I'm like, and they're like, no, you don't understand, because, like, you get the card and then that's attached to it. And then, like, you know, that's mine now. I've got that.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of it, some of it's mad and some of it's mad money. And the money side of it, as well as that's cool and it, you know, it's good to earn some money on stuff like that, I do worry that that's the side that can push out a fan base.
100%.
No one should be paying 20 grand for a digital trading card that is, doesn't even... 20 grand for a trading card that you can hold and maybe put in a laminate and be like, this is actually quite rare.
Yeah.
To one that is basically a double click on your desktop. Do you know what I mean?
For your metaverse. To hang in your metaverse. It's mad.
You know, I collect a lot of art in my house. I've got a lot of Dave White stuff. He's one of my favourite artists. I've got, you know, pictures and stuff of him. He, you know, paints a lot of like realism stuff, animals and everything else. So I've got a lot of his stuff. Anyone that doesn't know Dave White stuff,
would you pay 20 grand for that though?
No, but I would pay 20 grand because I can touch, feel it, and hold it. Well, that's what I was going to get to. I wouldn't pay crazy money for a Dave White NFT.
Yeah,
because I feel like I want the physicality of holding it, or not that you ever would, but if I wanted to, I could smash the glass and rip the fucking painting up. Because it's mine. You know, yeah. I've got it here. It's hard when it's like a digital thing. But maybe that's the old schoolness of people that, you know, in 20 years' time, this would be the weirdest conversation ever, because people are like, NFTs are normal. Everyone's got NFTs.
Yeah.
But that'll be the same time when we're all releasing 30-second tracks.
there's a couple of playlists on Spotify. I think it's called the Sad Cow or something playlist, where I don't know if you know about it, but he owns the playlist. It's got like, it's the biggest playlist on Spotify, like hands down.
Right.
And he makes all the music for it or signs all the music for it. And each record's 30 seconds. And because Spotify's rules are like the record to count for one stream.
An actual track, it has to be that long.
It has to be 30 seconds. But
it's a stream, 30 seconds, and then that counts as one stream.
Yeah, but because the track length is only 30 seconds, they don't have to listen to the whole 30 seconds. They literally just have to turn it on. So this dude is like generating insane amounts of money from just background music, 30 seconds long. He invests a lot of money into it.
I'm going to check it out after we've chatted, but is it a text? Or is it like music, or is it like when you drop like a vinyl sound in the background, or like almost like a field recording, or is it?
It's like trip hop, like really chill trip hop stuff. So it's like, it's mad what they're generating, like cash wise, but I kind of like that. It's kind of like, fuck the system. That is the other side of what we're saying, is that it's like, fuck it.
That's the thing. What you don't get nowadays as so much of is shit like that. It's like somebody going, okay, that's how you want to do it, then I'll beat you at your own game.
Exactly.
Like I remember back in, I don't know if it was in the, I can't remember who did it, but there was years ago when vinyl was insane, and everyone was, you know, spending loads of money on vinyl, and, you know, releases are doing 40,000 copies and stuff like that. And you had some of these massive labels going, right, everyone's eating up this vinyl and everyone's eating up the fact that it's exciting. We're going to put a record out and it's going to have nothing on either side. It's blank record, and people went mad and bought it.
Yeah.
Everyone bought it. I was like, you've got to have that, because obviously that's limited. It's like, there's no music on it. It's like a blank record. It's like buying when Supreme released a brick, and everyone went nuts and bought a brick. It's a house brick with a Supreme logo on it. Like, what? I mean, I'll probably buy that. But I find that still stupid. You know what I mean? It's shit like that. Shit like that, I find, I would buy it because I'm like, the balls of it, like the absolute balls to put that in a shop. So, yeah, fair play to them people for doing that, because there's not enough in the 70s, 80s, 90s, even early 2000s, there was a lot more ways to go, fuck you to the music industry, bigwigs.
Yeah.
When I say music industry, I don't mean punters, I mean the what controls it, and go, we're going to do it this way. And if you don't like that, then you do one, because this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
You can't really do that to a degree now. It's like, you can do that and they'll go, bye, we don't support you anymore.
Yeah.
And then you're like, whoa, you know, the power on top of you is way more than it used to be. You used to be able to make things happen by doing things differently. Nowadays, it's more harder to do that.
Yeah, have you seen the Shep Gordon documentary?
Yeah, yeah.
He was like the biggest king of just like, fuck them. Let's just do what fuck we want. And like, he was the main reason why like pretty much every big rock star and every big chef in the world is actually that famous now, because he kind of just like paved the way for his artists to just be like, let's just do the most obscene things. Like,
yeah, like, and then also like PR stunts and stuff to make things be mental. Like, you know, all that stuff's exciting. I think, you know, grabbing new fans by doing more mad stuff like that is a good way. It's very hard nowadays to do it, or to do it in a way that people understand why you've done it. Like, if you did something mental now, most people will go, you just want likes.
Yeah.
And you're actually doing it for the opposite. You're like, no, I'm trying to say that you don't need those.
Yeah.
But the minute you did something crazy and posted it online, and you're trying, even if you were saying in the video, this isn't for me to get likes, this is trying to explain that you don't need them, people go, yeah, I see what you're doing here.
Yeah.
You just want us to give you likes. It's like, get out of the headspace. For fuck's sake. It's stressful.
It's hard because it's so hard to just be authentic. That's the thing. To be your authentic self should technically be the easiest thing, but because the way tech companies are now, you kind of have to abide by what their rules are. And like Facebook, there's certain things that, like, one day your video will get 20,000 views, and the next day your post, like a week later, your post, you could post this the same video and it would get like 200 views, and you're like, fucking hell.
I still never understand all of that stuff. I still never get it. And all these companies are guilty of lots of things, you know. Like, I always say, I don't know if you've seen or if you've done posting on any of this, like, COVID stuff or something that mentions, even if it doesn't mention COVID, it comes out of this like disclaimer on these, like on Instagram, or, and it's, you've mentioned COVID, click here for COVID rules, right? Why can they not do that on online bullying or like this sort of stuff? Because it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Even if you haven't put the word in, it knows what you're talking about. So they're definitely disregarding stuff that they know that they're disregarding and putting on other stuff where they are just doing it because they think it's the right thing to do. So it's fucked. It's weird.
This is why I really like the concept of NFT and like the Web 3.0, because it actually takes out the middleman of the big companies, and it decentralizes the big companies so that it's not just a CEO running it. Which is kind of the concept that I love. It's just about bringing the core community to you. However, by doing that, you do alienate a lot of people that don't actually give a fuck about us that much to get involved fully.
That's another thing, isn't it? You've always got a degree of your fan base that are like, they like you. They like your music. They'll play your music until they, you know, get bored of it, but they're also like, don't know that much.
We're all the same, right? Like, how many artists do you listen to that you wouldn't be fucked to go and see live? You're not going to buy a ticket. And then how many artists do you go, you'll go see them live, but you won't buy a t-shirt?
Exactly. We're probably most people.
Exactly.
Right? We struggle with that. I'm like, how is that? But you're right. There's some hardcore people that want that stuff, and there's other people that are like, gig was wicked.
Yeah.
And there's also people that you're like, I kind of like them. I'm doing nothing today. I could go. I will go. Maybe I'll go. No, I won't go. Yeah, I'll go. Are you going? I'll go. We'll go.
Totally.
Do you know what I mean?
Totally, man. Like totally. Mate, I know you have to get on. We've literally just done an hour. And I don't want to run.
Mate,
over
that was shot by.
Yeah, mate. These conversations go on quickly. It's fucking wild. Just go on forever.
We can come back and do another one.
Yeah, mate. Sounds wicked. Before we go, let's do the promo shit that everyone has to do. Machine Therapy out now. What have you got coming out in the next couple of months?
So we've got a load of remixes of Machine Therapy that should be dropping over the next. The Jody Wistanoff one has actually just come out this week, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then, we're dropping a few more remixes. And then I think March time, we'll have a full remix album.
Amazing.
Of the tracks. And then going into sort of April and beyond, I think my next release outside of their sort of albumy stuff is I've done a track with DJ Dion, which is coming out on Shall Not Fade.
He's such a dude, man. I love that guy.
Yeah.
Love
so
that.
That's coming out, and then I think May, June, July, I've got some releases coming on Armada with Reset Robot.
Nice.
A release on Brave. I think I'm doing something with Factory 93.
Sick.
There's loads of stuff going on, man. It's, A few release dates are still a bit liquid, so I don't know specifically when some stuff's coming, but there's loads of new music from me coming over the next 12 months on various imprints. So yeah, I'm excited.
Amazing, man. Thanks for coming on. Keep safe and hopefully see you in a club soon.
Yeah, nice, man.
Cheers,
nice,
fella. Thanks. Take it easy, mate.
Yeah. Take it easy.
Keep safe. Big love. Bye. And that's a wrap. Big love for listening. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to give us some ratings. Comment if you want. Share it to your mates. Share it to your family. Your gran, maybe. She might like it. Have a wonderful week. Keep safe.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.